Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. Happy Earth Day, by the way. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tonight on Milwaukee Public Television on this Earth Day, a really wonderful documentary. It's Milwaukee, a City Built on Water. And it features John Gerda, who's been with us many times, wonderful Milwaukee historian. Water is definitely, he wrote in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, definitely a hot topic after decades as a vital but neglected resource, John says. Water has made a clear turn to the center of public attention. We also get a great history lesson of what the Milwaukee River was like, why Milwaukee played a key role in lots of populations, Native Americans and people from Europe coming to Milwaukee. They came here because they could get here by water. We're also going to take a look at when the Milwaukee River was almost dead, the problems we're facing with Lake Michigan, but how it's improved in quality over recent years, maybe because of the Clean Water Act and attention to the earth. So we have so much to talk about, and I do hope you'll watch the documentary tonight because you will learn so much, and you wish that you could have lived when you could swim in the river and go down water slides, and it wasn't that long ago. Maybe someday. Maybe someday. So John Gerda is joining us in our Milwaukee studios. He's a historian, a preeminent Milwaukee historian. He's the author of 19 books, Life Insurance, Frank Lloyd Wright, Heavy Industries, Historic Cemeteries, maybe Seminaries is the next one. The Making of Milwaukee is Gerda's most ambitious effort, 450 pages, 500 illustrations, cast of thousands. It's the first feature-length history of the community published since 1948. And Milwaukee Public Television premiered the Emmy Award-winning documentary series. He worked with Claudia Luz, who is in our studios with John on that series. Claudia is an independent filmmaker and also the program manager for Wisconsin Eye Network, a state government channel that's privately financed and editorially independent. And so she was involved in producing with some incredible footage tonight's documentary on water. Claudia, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having
us.
Yeah,
our pleasure. And John, always a pleasure to see you. I really like this, and I was born in the wrong era, if you don't mind, because you also have said that this is some striking footage, which I couldn't believe there was footage of people ice skating on bicycles on the
Absolutely
Milwaukee River.
Amazing.
I didn't even know they took movies at that time, but boy, that river was the place to be.
Yeah, 1917, the city of Milwaukee had ice carnivals, and we found this footage at the MPS Recreation Division. And I think it's 8 minutes, and Claudia, we use probably
seven minutes and 58 seconds.
And it's wonderful stuff. Chair
Amazing.
Races, wheelbarrow races.
Cops in their uniforms, and they're joining in on all the races.
Sled dogs. There was a ski jump in Gordon Park, and all this took place on the river between Gordon and Riverside Parks, which is just downstream from the Locust Street Bridge. So it was fantastic, and the thing that has gotten so many people's attention when we've shown the video is they couldn't race during the wintertime, but they had these kind of toothed back wheels for these bicycles, and on the front fork they put a skate blade in place of a tire. So we dubbed them icicles.
Icicles, yes. First we just had the photograph, and then the people actually Brian Hoffer over at the rec department said, John, I have this box, and it's got some movies in it, and it had film footage of them riding these icicles. And then tell them about
the story you were reading from, Kathleen, in the paper on April 5th. I got an email the very next day from a man named Jerry Steele in Elm Grove, I believe. And he said that was my father on the front bike and a friend of his on the back bike.
Oh,
so, and it turned out the Steele family, there were four or five brothers, and they had a grandfather who taught them blacksmithing. So they knew how to work metal, and they made racing bikes for the summertime. And they said, well, we'll put a skate blade on the front fork, and we'll have, and they called them ice bikes. And not only did he know the story, he had a genuine ice bike.
Oh, my goodness.
And
so send me a picture of it.
Oh. You want to reshoot John on the icicle bike.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd like to see John on one of those as well. And in the summertime, I love to swim, to see all those swimming schools and to see people enjoying moonlight cruises on the Milwaukee River. And canoe clubs and this huge water slide. I would love to see one of those again. I wonder if the river, you could do that in the river right now, but it was just the place to be. It was summertime. It was like being up north,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly. Yeah, we called it In Town Up North. And again, back in those days, it was a one-day weekend, so you didn't have the luxury of being able to take even a two-day weekend and go up to, you know, Dodge County, even that close. So the ride, they called it Shoot the Chutes, and it was on the east bank of the river just above North Avenue, just around North Avenue, and it cost a dime. And it was essentially a water slide, this car that kind of came down the incline and splashed, you know, made a huge splash as it hit the water. Then they kind of had some kind of tether, and they kind of winch it back to the top of the hill again and do it again. And we quoted, a newspaper reporter said that it was irresistible for young people, because it was the young woman would sort of lean into her bow in a moment of fright. So
just before the plunge, metaphorical. Yes. And it wasn't just, you know, 50, 100 people. It was thousands of people.
Yep.
I mean, it was really, for all of this activity. And now you go down there and you don't see anybody. I mean, there's some people on the bike trails, but it's just such a reverse of what was
Yeah, well,
was
you
like
start to see more kayakers and people
yes.
canoeing and all on the river, but
yes.
boy, to be able to swim in that baby again,
right.
that would be terrific. So let's talk about way, way back. Obviously, water is a crucial thing to our lives. We can't exist without water. So this huge lake, this beautiful body of water, all of these rivers became, for Native Americans, the place to be. And I think you call it canoe. We canoed
yeah.
in those days.
Yeah, people of the canoe, you know, the Potawatomi and all their neighbors, certainly. They got here by water. They got around by water. And they used water resources, the Menominee Valley. Menominee means wild rice. And that was their grocery store, certainly water-based. So Milwaukee was built on water for our native predecessors and built on water for the pioneers as well who came here from the East Coast.
And then we no longer traveled by canoe. We traveled by schooner?
Traveled by schooner. You know, that was the next revolution in transportation. And it's hard to imagine how important that was. You know, now we look at the lake and it's recreation, it's weather, it's our drinking water, it sort of sets our mood. But that's how you got here. And that's why Milwaukee exists. It was the best natural harbor on the western shore of the lake. So people looked at the river coming down to the lake and said, this will be a city. And as it turns out, they were right. So this was the premier urban opportunity on the west shore of the lake. Chicago and Milwaukee were the real competitors. And Chicago had a canal that took all the way down to the Mississippi, basically. So they were ahead of the game in that way. But in the age of sail, they were 90 miles farther away from the East Coast by water. So we were neck and neck in population for about 15 years. Then, of course, the railroad comes.
Mm-hmm.
And
changes everything.
They're four times our size within 10 or 20 years.
Yeah. So you could get, I found this interesting, at one point, I never imagined this, you could get from Liverpool all the way to Milwaukee and do it all by water.
You could, yep.
That's amazing.
You get out once in a while. And stretch your legs.
I hope so, yeah.
Stretch your legs in Albany. Stretch your legs in Buffalo. But otherwise, you could be in waterborne transportation. You know, the big sailing ships across the ocean, then the canal boats across the Erie Canal, upstate New York, and then schooners or sidewheel steamships by the later 1830s down the Great Lakes.
You spend quite a bit of time, and it's really an interesting story with this Polish settlement, this urban settlement on Jones Island.
Uh-huh.
Which is pretty interesting. And the
Very
pictures that you got there were extraordinary. Where are all those?
Well, I used to do a lot of work with Milwaukee Public Television, making of Milwaukee. And the receptionist at Milwaukee Public Television had an aunt, Aunt Hildegard, who had photo
really?
Albums. And they are stunning photographs. And her uncle must have been quite a photographer, because on a lot of the photographs it would say f-stop 2.0, cloudy day, this lens. So she let me scan all those photographs. So those are her family treasures and heirlooms.
Yeah, we use those in Making in Milwaukee. We
yes.
use them in Built on Water. And it'd be kind of fun to do just a half-hour documentary about
Only,
just Jones Island.
Yep, the Kashubes.
The Kashubes.
Yes. Didn't you do your master's thesis?
I did, yeah. Yeah.
Oh, did you really?
I did. Yeah, huh. It's called People of the Port, Ethnic Succession on Milwaukee's Jones Island.
Huh.
You have to have larger words than a thesis.
So and explain where it was, because I think a lot of people do not even, there's not much evidence there.
Almost nothing. It's where the sewage treatment plant is, the port facilities, and the Hone Bridge, which is the main landmark. And most of what you see on Jones Island today is landfill. And there's one little piece on the west bank called Kashubes Park. and it's about the size of
the studio.
maybe someone's backyard, yes. You know, is about it. And that's all that remains of what had been a settlement that at one time had 1,600 people. So
how many bars, taverns?
11 at one time.
Good ratio.
And they were squatters, weren't they?
They were squatters, didn't pay taxes and didn't receive much in the way of services. And they're called Kashubes because they're from the Kashubi region on the Baltic Sea coast of Poland. So they're Polish ethnically, but kind of a subgroup. Not unlike, say, Bavarians in Germany. You know, they're German speakers, but you know, have their own dialect and their own culture as well.
And they fished.
They fished 2 million pounds in an average year. So they were bringing up lots and lots of fish. And back in those days, it was lake trout, which are pretty much wiped out as certainly a commercial fish. All the commercial fishing is pretty much done. There's no longer anyone fishing from Milwaukee. You know, they're farther north. But cisco, which is a kind of herring, whitefish, sturgeon. So there was a lot of protein hauled up from those lakes and ended up on dinner plates in Milwaukee. Mm. And lots of fish fries.
Did they start the fish fries?
That's one of the urban legends. It would be hard to document. It wasn't as someone said, I'm going to have a fish fry and it's going to become a Wisconsin institution. But it certainly made sense because here you have this incredibly abundant supply of fresh fish right there.
Yeah.
And all these saloons who were trying to get customers, thirsty customers, to come in and sample their wares.
Let's talk about the story of industry, but let's start with a lamentable part of history, with the Milwaukee River being essentially dead. I didn't realize it was as dead as it was as long ago as it was. I thought it was thriving for a long period of time, but it wasn't. It was horrible. It
certainly was.
When was that, Claudia?
You're better with the dates, but what was happening is we would just, you know, throw our trash and our human sewage and our dead animals, everything into the lake and into the river, and there would be industries that would just have their discharges going right into the river. But they came up with a pretty interesting way to clear the water of the river. But how bad did it really get?
It got so bad that there were people who would actively avoid the Milwaukee River in high summer. And this is at a time, 1880s, 1870s, yes. And by that time the river had been docked and dredged. So there wasn't much current there. It was industrial, it was human, but probably the single biggest source of pollution there was horse-drawn transportation.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So you have tons of manure that would plop onto Milwaukee streets every day, and nobody was cleaning that stuff up. You know, it would rain, and it would just go down the drain into the nearest river. So in the hot days of summer, you have this concoction that would just, it was sort of sit there
cook,
and cook.
As you put it, yes.
So it was horrific.
Mm. But the best solution they came up with is, they, like right here downtown, they were just going to put a deck over the river and use it as a grand boulevard.
Right.
Just as a way to like
cover up,
put
smell,
it out of sight, out of mind.
Gosh.
Back in the 1920s.
And wasn't it true that you didn't want an office on the side that faced the river?
No, boy, you would not want an open window anywhere near that river back in the later 1800s.
Mm. It was just open sewer.
It got better for a time, at least, in the later 1880s. 1888, along the lakefront at the foot of the Lafayette Hill, they put in a nice cream city brick building, the largest water pump in the whole world, dug a tunnel under the east side and used the fresh lake water to flush the putrid river. So the river got cleaner because it was flushed with lake water, but all that filth goes into the lake.
Collectivo now, right?
Exactly.
Yes.
As we said in the video, it's ironic that you have upscale beverages being sold in a facility that was built to move a little murkier liquid.
Exactly.
But they were moving all of that putrid water out to the lake, right into the intake for our drinking water.
Oh, my.
So then Milwaukeeans were coming down with, well, they used to call it intestinal flu. It was actually typhoid. And that people were dying of a third world disease right here in one of the first class cities.
Yeah.
Yep.
Well, when was Increase Lapham around? Wasn't it around this time? Didn't he point
to what was
going on?
He came here back in the 1830s or 1840s, and he was back in 1867. He published a report on the disastrous effects of the destruction of forest trees. And basically what he's saying is you're chopping down all the trees, so you're accelerating runoff, and that means you've got too much water in spring and not enough in fall. So you have the river being pretty much denatured, and his solution was to plant trees. Mm-hmm. and now we're doing that. The sewage district here has a program called Green Seams, and they're doing precisely what Lapham suggested back in 1857.
He was a smart guy. We just need to listen to people a little earlier.
Exactly, that's when we make that point.
Yeah, he's one of our heroes, yes. Claudia's and mine.
I know, I keep saying maybe we need to do a documentary on increased
Lapham.
That's
a good idea. Yep. So you have all this water, and I don't think we appreciated it very much, but it also allowed certain businesses, and talk about those businesses, to thrive here because they needed a lot of water, like beer.
They all did. For the machinery companies, they had to have water to cool their engines. For the tanners, they used huge amounts of water. But certainly beer was the one that was used it most directly. And it was certainly a supply of good, cold, clear, fresh water here, largely groundwater, largely what came up from springs. But also, and this is sometimes forgotten, back in those years, you would brew in winter and sell in summer. So it was kind of a seasonal business, which meant you had to have something to cool that beverage during the warm months, and that was ice. So we have true winter here, and we're not quite out of it yet in 2015.
No, I know. Yeah.
But they would harvest ice in inland lakes and on the upper Milwaukee River as well. So within sight of those swimming schools in summertime, in the wintertime, they would have these huge crews cutting ice and storing it in these sawdust-insulated ice houses. So that was really important, a competitive advantage for Milwaukee's brewers.
We'll move on and talk about we have to look at where things are now and any kind of historical questions. Feel free to call about that, but we want to talk about the freshwater school, which is very important in the world, and water is so important in the world right now as well. And also, you can tell, if you've lived here for a while, you can tell how things have picked up. The river, more people are living along the river, they're using it for recreation. We'll talk about the problems that the lake is facing now. I didn't realize what's on the bottom of the lake, which makes it so clear. So we'll find out about that, and whether or not there comes a time, when there's no water in California and there's no water in Arizona and there's no water in a lot of places, what's going to happen to the Great Lakes? This hour, we're talking about the documentary that will be on tonight on Earth Day, Milwaukee, a City Built on Water, on Milwaukee Public Television at 8 o'clock, and it's really well done. John Gerda wrote the script, and he is the host for the program. Claudia Luz is the collaborated with John. She's an independent filmmaker and the program manager for Wisconsin Eye Network, and they work together on their huge Making of Milwaukee series. So we welcome phone calls. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we are also on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we go to Dave for our first caller from Key Wascom. Hi, Dave.
Hello.
Hi.
Just a couple observations. I cover the state in outside sales, and the two things that really concern me are these large corporate farms that are popping up along all over in Wisconsin, with where the ground isn't really capable of holding the amount of runoff from these large farms. And then the other thing the other concern I have are the Asian carp that are threatening Lake Michigan. And I'll take your response off the air.
Thank you, Dave. John.
Second question first. Asian carp are certainly a serious threat to the ecosystem, but it's, I think, sometimes misunderstood. They are a river fish, and they need larger, longer, narrower bodies of water to thrive in. So they are not so much a threat in the open lake as they are in the rivers. So Lake Michigan is already a pretty bollocksed ecosystem, so the river is what is really in danger for the carp. And they may already be here. For all we know, maybe coming through Green Bay, maybe up the Mississippi. It's not just Chicago, so that's pretty hard to put that genie back in the bottle.
So, how is Lake Michigan bollocksed? And give me a history here.
It goes back to the first introductions back in 1829. Was the first canal that bypassed the Niagara Falls, And ever since then, you've got these exotic species that have been coming upriver into the Great Lakes. And the ones we know best are most familiar are the schmelt, as we call them. You know, they go back to 1923. They're an ocean fish, and they became certainly a delicacy, something that was a rite of spring for people all over Wisconsin. But then you have the sea lamprey comes in. Remember the year, Claudia? It was the 40s?
Oh, my gosh. Yes.
But they prey on the lake trout, which are the boss predators. They're the top of the food chain, and they don't wipe them out, but they just
devastate their population.
Devastate the population. So it takes a nosedive. There's actually a nosedive in the video.
Yeah.
So the alewife comes in the later 40s, and there's nothing to eat them. So they take over the entire lake.
And they're stinky.
Oh, they are stinky.
In the 80s?
Yeah, 60s, 70s, 80s. No, they would die off with changes in temperature. They'd kind of wash up on the beach, and they just sort of sit there and rot, just like the river used to with all that manure in it. Most recently, and this is something you really don't see because unless you're a diver, you're not going underneath, but the zebra mussels came in the ballast water of ocean-going ships coming from the Black and Caspian Seas. And these little organisms, they took over. No, they just they found a very welcoming home here. The zebras were relatively near shore. They were pretty much displaced by the quagga. And they carpet the bottom of that lake
all the way to
the bottom of it. Yep.
Quagga.
And they're no more, they're no larger than your fingernail. And what they do is they're filter feeders, so they clean the water. And one can, I think, filter maybe a quart of water a day. So divers I've talked to said that back in the late 80s, you'd be lucky if you could see 6 feet in front of your face with a light. Now, you know, it's 50, 60 feet.
Wow.
So the water is much clearer. But the downside, obviously, is that they coat everything from water intakes to the shipwrecks that are down there. So it literally is a carpet. And they take the bottom of the food chain out from underneath the natives. So the perch have crashed. What they depend on is all those little microorganisms that are also the quagga mussels' food. So the quagga filter those through, they digest them, and they excrete their waste as a fertilizer. And what that does, because you've got more light and fertilizer there, the cladophora algae, no, has just exploded. So you see that stuff. Now it's sort of, we're in a little better shape than we were several years ago, but you can recall a few years ago when the stuff would just wash up and
yes.
You had these mats of cladophora that were 2-3 feet thick. And just like the alewives back in the 70s, it would sit there and rot.
So why are we in a little better shape now than we were a few years ago?
There are theories that it's when the quagga displaced the zebra. The zebras had a lot of algae on them, and they washed ashore. So that would have been a peak of volume of the algae coming in. But it's still out there. It still gets torn off in storms, and it still comes up. So it's certainly a continuing danger to this area.
You mentioned in the documentary that there are places now, and you even put a little fishy back in the water, which I'd like for you to, hoping that your children will meet its children down the road. But the river is showing signs of much more life, isn't it? There's more fishing taking place in salmon, and that's something that I think most people aren't aware of. That river's getting some life again.
Right, right. We were down to how many species in the...
I think it was 8, and they were all carp and goldfish.
Right.
Wow.
Now we're up to 40? 40 different
really?
Species.
Really?
And we have lots
Holy
of fishermen
cow.
That are out there.
Yep.
Some beautiful footage of people fishing in the Milwaukee River.
And now the North Avenue Dam is out. There's a fish passage at Thiensville, so they can go all the way up into Ozaukee, Washington counties. So it's that really is a reborn resource and a resurrected recreation as well.
Yeah. What do you put in the water in the documentary?
What do we put in the water?
A sturgeon. A sturgeon named Francis. Yes,
named Francis.
Yeah, you can't tell their gender, so we called him Francis. Called him her.
Francis.
And what will Francis's story be?
We don't know.
We don't know, but we hope that he or she comes back in how many years? 20-some years?
20 to 30. It takes them a long time to get old enough to spawn.
Yes.
They must have a difficult adolescence.
I had no idea they lived that long. That's amazing.
Oh, more than 100 years. But this is a partnership of the DNR and River Edge Nature Center up there around Newburg. And what they do is they grow them, the fry, in river water up there at River Edge. And then when they're big enough, and how long were they, how big were they, Claudia?
They were about 5-6 inches
long. 5-6 inches?
Yep.
And then they have sturgeon fest in fall.
Yes.
And you make a donation, and they give you fish and a little, little ice cream
pail.
Yep. You go down and let it go, and wish it luck.
It's a great thing to take kids to. And
very kid-friendly event.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot of fun. And the point we made was that this would have been absolutely unthinkable in the years when the river was so polluted. So ever since 1972, when the Fresh Water Act was passed and the deep tunnel, which became operational in 1993, the water quality has rebounded, and that has made it possible to consider this ancient native making it its home again. So Wisconsin has, in Lake Winnebago and that whole system, we have the largest reproducing population of sturgeon in the entire world. So it's a big deal. And putting them back in the lake is certainly an act of hope and faith.
Yeah.
And justice as well. No, they were evicted. Now they're coming back.
Yeah, I'm going to have to get into them.
Mm-hmm.
This is a whole new thing for me. That'd be a good thing to know. You mentioned the deep tunnel. How is that doing? Is it overflowing? How often does it not do what it's supposed to do?
The numbers, certainly when you have these huge storm events, it will be on occasion overwhelmed, but it gets much worse press than it deserves, because that entire system allows the district to capture more than 98% of this region's wastewater. And there were times when you didn't have that. No, it would just sort of flow directly into the lake. So it still happens, but in much, much smaller quantities and far less often than it did.
Let's go next to Tom in Appleton. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Kathleen. I would like to ask the guests, I think I read once that there used to be a fish in Lake Michigan, and I think it was called the blue pike, and it is no longer present. If I was correct in what I read, I thought it was related to walleye and perch.
That is a new one to me. We have to talk to Will Warzen, who's the DNR fisheries guy. Blue pike's new one to me.
New one to me, too. I used to produce for Outdoor Wisconsin, but I had not heard of the blue pike.
The story was that this thing was already gone in the 1800s, it's long-term loss to the ecosystem.
So we'll talk about once in a blue pike.
Or the return.
Or
the blue
return of the blue pike. sturgeon, move over.
Oh, my.
All right.
Thanks, Tom. Yeah, thanks for the call. Email from someone in 1874, Milwaukee Sentinel article called the Menominee, the River of Death, disgusting in the extreme to the site and fearfully offensive to the factories.
Yeah, great prose. The Milwaukee River was described as a currentless and yellowish murky stream with water-like oil and an odor combined of the effluvia of 100 sewers.
Ooh!
Pretty colorful prose. And they were all like that. It was the Milwaukee, it was the Menominee, and it was the Kinnickinnick as well. They were all filthy beyond description by modern standards. And the Menominee, because it has such an industrial base there, in the heart of the Menominee Valley, you have the biggest industrial concentration in the entire state. And you have these tanneries, and they weren't hauling that stuff off-site. They were just dumping that in the river.
Oh.
I can recall in the 70s, working at a youth center on the south side called Journey House, we'd take kids photographing the Menominee Valley, and I can actually recall on one of the canals, now a South Canal, around 11th Street, where you actually saw carp coming up for air because there was no oxygen in that water. So that river was, it's been pretty much dead for a long time, and that's coming back. Talk about the Milwaukee River, but the Menominee Valley is clean industry to the west, and you've got the Pottawatomie Casino, you've got the Harley-Davidson Museum. Mm-hmm. Just as you could not have imagined the sturgeon being transplanted to Lake Michigan 25, 30 years ago, who would have imagined Harley-Davidson putting a museum in the heart of the Menominee Valley that long ago?
And those bike trails and the Hank Aaron Trail down there.
Yeah, it's all different. It's yes. really quite something.
Urban ecology centers down there.
Yes.
They're using that river as a classroom.
Mm-hmm. What about the Freshwater Sciences School? Hey, let's talk about what this is all going to mean. It is the largest facility of its kind in the world, I think you say in the documentary, don't you?
I think it's the only in the country.
Certainly
is unique. And that goes back. The UWM has been doing research since back in the 1970s, you know, using the lake as kind of a research area. And things have kind of, they've evolved, they've snowballed. So as the science has grown, as economic applications have grown, and they were given that facility by Alan Bradley, now Rockwell Automation, down there in the Inner Harbor, mm-hmm. you know, right across from Jones Island. And if you haven't been inside there, it's just worth a visit. They have everything from these robots that will go underwater to measure turbulence in water to these huge fish tanks that they're doing, you know, essentially aquaculture in, down there. So it's a lot of fun to see, and that program has grown, drawing people from all over the country and researchers as well from all over the world. Mm. So it's a real feather in Milwaukee's cap.
It is, indeed. So you ask the questions, and they are pretty big questions. We're talking about major drought in California, with people having to lower their water use 25%, and that's probably only going to get worse. Arizona, states fighting about water. When we sit around and think about what that whole body of water is going to mean for alleviating a drought or for supplying fresh water to places that desperately need it, how do we answer that?
I think we raise the question, and this is where public policy comes into it. I mean, it's right here in our own region with Waukesha. I mean, they have problems with their wells and would like to use water out of our lake, but they're in a different watershed.
Mm-hmm.
So can we transport water there if it doesn't go back into the system? It's a real public policy question right here in our neck of the woods. But remember, the Great Lakes are 20% of the amount. There's a certain amount of fresh water on the planet. We have 20% of it right here.
Mm-hmm.
And as we point out in the doc, that, you know, we do import oil from Saudi Arabia. Could we be exporting water to other parts of the region or other parts of the planet? And can we do that, or should we do that? So I think it's an important question, and the timing couldn't be better, especially with the droughts out west.
Certainly mm-hmm. could. And we were just out there seeing a sun in Washington State and spent some time with friends in California, and they're still irrigating. The golf courses are still green. They still serve you water at the restaurants. So I think just as most human beings live in a state of denial, and that's true certainly of climate change. I think it's true of the West in terms of their water problems. But that's something that is just going to stare them right in the face in, you know, the very near future. And they are going to look to us. Back probably maybe 12, 15 years ago at this time, Bill Richardson, who was New Mexico's governor,
mm-hmm.
Was talking about New Mexico. They don't have a whole lot of water. He's talking about the Great Lakes. He said, we need to have that conversation. Maybe we don't. You know, this is a resource that has been evolving for the last 10,000 years since the last glaciers left. And we have already made it kind of a science fair experiment to further tinker with it by exporting water to places that are not husbanding their resource. That's certainly, it's public policy. That debate will occur on a national level.
International.
Canada would have to be involved with
it. As well. But I think that's a clear and present danger to a resource that we've always taken for granted and need not to.
No. Mm-hmm. Well, that's why you do a documentary.
That's exactly.
And when it's well done, it gets more attention. Let's go to Earl next in. Our number, by the way, is 800-486-8655. We're talking about On This Earth Day, a documentary airing tonight on Milwaukee Public Television, Milwaukee, a City Built on Water. It's very well done. It gives you the history of water. Great video and pictures of what this area looked like long, long ago and what it may look like and what the current issues are for the rivers and the lakes. Earl in Medford, hi.
Hi, great show. I'd like to know about public access to the lake. What's there and what should be there? We think yacht clubs, estates, golf clubs, or trails and rails and...
Well, let's go to, there's an interesting part where the lake became accessible because of the landfill that was put in near Bradford Beach, right? It's a
exactly.
public area.
Yeah, before that time, Lincoln Memorial Drag was back to 1929. Before then, it was railroad tracks. So there was no access down there. And something going on now is debate about the public trust doctrine, which is any filled lake bed has to be used for the public use of some sort. Can't be used commercially, can't be used for private gain. So Wisconsin has mandated access to both Lake Michigan and to inland lakes as well. So there has to be access on any lake of a certain size. And I think that's part of our own state's ethos. Down south, maybe, I think about that. A state park has to have a golf course and a swimming pool. You know, here, wilderness is something we value, and access to those resources is something we value. And all up and down the lake, it's not that hard to get down to it and to use it. In Milwaukee County, more than half of our shoreline is in the public domain.
Is it really?
Yep, and we've done that well. We need to pat ourselves on the back.
That's wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
That is wonderful. Thanks, Earl, for your call. Let's go to Ron in Norwalk. Hi, Ron.
Hi there. The previous fellow had a comment about the big dairy producers, big farms that are adding a lot of their manure waste to the ground in Wisconsin, and there is a solution to that. I was at a dairy open house last week up here in our area. They're milking 1,500 to 2,000 cows, going up to 2,500. They've got about, 30 acres under roof.
Wow.
And the solution to that problem is he is drying the manure, composting it, bagging it, and putting it or selling the product as fertilizer, or putting it back on the ground as dry fertilizer. Excellent product used in gardens everywhere throughout the United States. So there is a solution to that. Some farmers are using it for energy, actually electrical energy, in the DeForest area in Wisconsin.
Yeah, there's a farm I'm aware of up around Casco up in Manitowoc County, up in that area, and they have around, I think, 6,000 cows, young stock as well as milking cows, and it's almost a closed system. You can see the milk is being shipped out to Waupun. The manure is put into kind of this slurry tank, and they use the liquids to fertilize, and they take the solids out and dry them and use them for bedding for the animals.
Huh.
So sort of recycling. And from that slurry tank, they burn off the methane and make electricity. So there are responsible solutions. I think what happens is when you have an operator who's maybe not on top of his or her game, you know, then it goes into the nearest stream, and you've had some horrendous fish kills, you know, when it gets into to local streams. So like anything, things can go wrong, but there are right ways to do it.
Yeah. Tell us the Milorganite story.
Milorganite, that goes back to 1925 when Milwaukee opened its first sewage plant. And before then, Claudia and I were talking about the flushing station. And then, obviously, it was just moving sewage. And Milwaukee began to treat it in 1925. And we introduced what was called activated sludge. It was European in origin, but Milwaukee was the first to adopt it in the U.S. So we were ahead of the curve.
Hmm.
And what that meant was you had little microorganisms that would digest the waste and sort of neutralize its toxicity. And then once they'd done their work, they would die off. And what we did was we dried them and bagged them and sold them as Milorganite. So an ultimate act of civic recycling and beloved of golf course superintendents around the country.
More phone calls in a moment. The number is 800-486-8655. It's Earth Day. We're talking about Milwaukee and water. Milwaukee, a city built on water. Documentary tonight at 8 on Milwaukee Public Television. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go back to phone calls. And Tom in Madison is next. Hi, Tom.
Hello.
Hi, Tom.
Hey, I'm wondering, listening to the show, and you talked about the airing tonight on Milwaukee Public Television, but do you know any air dates for Wisconsin Public Television?
We're working on that, but it also will be on Wisconsin Eye tonight.
Oh.
And Wisconsin Eye is on Charter, Channel 995, and also on Time Warner 363. So we'll be simulcasting. We'll be doing it at 8 o'clock tonight, and then again Thursday, tomorrow, at 9 p.m. And it's also going to be on Channel 36 here in the Wisconsin area tomorrow night.
Will it be streamed?
Yes, and it will, you can watch it on demand probably after 9 o'clock tonight. We'll have it online at wisseye.org. That's W-I-S-E-Y-E.org. And you can watch it on demand.
Anytime, day or night.
Anytime, day or night.
Many times.
Yes.
All right, Tom?
Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call. We go to Terry. Hi, Terry.
Hello?
Hi, Terry.
Yeah, I would like to compare Milwaukee with Detroit and also put in a plug for my favorite journalist, Charlie LeDuc, who has done a lot to, you know, with the progress they've made in the environment and stuff, and he has a wonderful video on YouTube about canoeing the rivers of Detroit.
I'm reading that book. It's called Detroit, an American Autopsy.
Are you serious? You're reading the book?
Yeah.
Isn't this fortuitous that Terry called to talk about this?
That's amazing.
That is
good
amazing.
Book.
So how would you compare the two cities, John?
Are you talking about environmentally or in terms of their histories? Or
canoe trip.
Canoe trips?
Yeah, canoe trip on, I forget the name of the river. It's the main drainage river in Detroit. And
Lake
talking about the water and...
Lake St. Clair is right off the offshore. You got the Detroit and St. Clair rivers up and down. I am not aware of canoe routes around Detroit, and I don't think they have much inland water. Milwaukee has three rivers that are all canoeable, and they converge on the lakefront, obviously. And there is actually we've got a copy at home. It's the Milwaukee Water Trail, and it shows places you can go on all three rivers. And now, my family and I canoe probably two or three times a summer, and there we made a count last year. There are seven places you can stop to have dinner.
Really?
which was impossible even 15 years ago.
Huh.
So certainly Milwaukee is a very increasingly bike-friendly but also canoe and kayak-friendly. So becoming a destination for water sports. I'm sorry I can't comment more on comparisons with Detroit. They are going back to nature in a different way with all the housing demolitions they've had there. They are talking about multi-acre urban farms in the hearts of old neighborhoods. Hmm. So hope for a resurrection there as well.
Hmm. Thank you so much for your call. Deborah in Brown Deer. Hi.
Hi. I really appreciate the show, Kathleen. This is the whole 2 hours has been awesome. But I'm really fanatic about water. I grew up on Lake Superior, and I've sailed from Mackinac Island up to the North Channel down to Lake Lake Huron to Detroit. I never canoed it, but I want to comment about wells. There used to be water wells where people would get water from filling up their buckets. Or, I mean their little milk cartons, but then I made a phone call to the DNR and I spoke to the water guy. That was his label, and he said there was one out in the area, and he said, "I implore you not to drink out of that water from that spring. There, you know, was agricultural runoff in it when I tested it last year, so that got closed. Now there's one in Bayview. I think that was the only one left open. There used to be one in Germantown, and I don't know if the one in Port Washington is still open. Are you aware of all these springs that people can get water from?
Well, Bayview had a problem. It was on the news a few weeks ago, right? That there was something wrong with the water?
That actually, I live in Bayview, and that the well there on Pryor Avenue goes back to the early 1880s when Bayview was an independent village, and that was their water supply. It was for both fire protection and for household water. And when it was brand new, they talked about they tapped an artesian well, so it was under pressure, and it was kind of a geyser when they sort of hit the impermeable layer. And as development occurred, the water table dropped and dropped and dropped, so now the city helps it along with a pump. During the cryptosporidium crisis, 10, 15 years ago, I remember people lined up around the corner their bottles filled with Pryor Avenue well, they call it the iron well, because it had a lot of iron dissolved in it. And now it was tested just weeks ago, and it tested high in strontium, which is, it was certainly at safe levels, but there was some reason for caution.
Oh,
so that may be. And I think it's naturally occurring. So it's like radon in the Waukesha wells, but excessive quantities can be quite harmful. So, yes, and I think that is the last place in Bayview. That's the last place in Milwaukee County you can get water that's not from Lake Michigan and put through our water systems.
I thought it was traced back to Lake Superior. Isn't that true?
That's one of the urban legends, but that doesn't work hydrologically. we're on the other side of the subcontinental divide.
That's what I thought.
So. Yeah. Unless somebody put a pipeline a long time ago.
Thanks very much for the call, Deborah. Michael on Facebook writes, will the lake sturgeon eat the new zebra mussel? If not, what will?
What I've heard from the fisheries people is that the whitefish will eat the quagga mussel. And whitefish are not a game fish. They're kind of live in the bottom, and you'll come once in a while, but they aren't like trout. They're not fighters. And that's become, you see it in all the grocery stores, so it's become a very popular staple. And up Lake Superior, you know, it's kind of what you get in restaurants is when you're looking for fish there. So that is one of the very few sort of edible fishes that have shown any kind of appreciable gain, and it may be related to the fact that they will eat quaggas. But the bottom of the food chain, you know, sort of like cutting off a tree at its roots, you know, so that has huge impacts on the future of the other fisheries there.
Mm-hmm. You know, one thing that the documentary is so beautifully photographed, but you also realize, maybe we don't appreciate it as much as we do, that the city is really beautiful. The water, you know, if it weren't like Michigan, it'd be some, I don't know where it would be, Des Moines, people frequently say, no Great Lake, you know.
Right.
It's just, it is beautiful.
It's
beautiful in all the area near Summerfest and that area where you can walk now and bike and you're canoeing up and down the river on this documentary. The water makes it. It makes the city.
Water has defined the city.
Certainly,
right.
Yeah.
Not only the industry, but the way it looks. And it is beautiful.
And you go out west, go to a town like L.A., go to Santa Fe, go to Tucson. And if I'm out there for any more than a day or two, I get dry.
Right. I'm with you.
Feel sort of desiccated. And also, if you're out on the West Coast, you know, the ocean's gorgeous, obviously. It always feels strange for Milwaukee and the lake's on the wrong side.
Exactly.
You shouldn't look west to water. But you're right, Kathleen. This is our rivers and our lake are priceless resources whose cost we have diminished over the years and are finally investing in again. So it's high time, and there are some areas of damage, especially all those invasive species, that may not be undone. No, that may be a permanently bollocked ecosystem. But compared to the rivers, especially our ancestors knew, we are on the upswing and continuing.
Yeah. Isn't it amazing, though, as you look historically, that people didn't realize, that somebody just didn't, when they're putting something in the river, thinking, this may not be a very good thing to do. I'm amazed how we could walk around being so unaware for so long.
It's the same thing as the northern pineries. You know, you have these trees that are 150 years old, and you say, you don't look at that and say it's gorgeous. You look at that and say it's houses. So it's what you can use. And we tend to be a fairly exploitative species. And that goes back to our ancestors tens of thousands of years ago.
Yeah. Well, congratulations. It's just a lovely film and an important film, and I'm glad you did it. And please tell us again, because I keep saying Milwaukee Public Television,
yes,
but you can see it all over the state.
Yes, it'll be on Milwaukee Public Television, who has been our collaborative partner. But Wisconsin Eye was the production entity of the program, and it'll be on Wisconsin Eye, which is at wisseye.org, wisseye.org. So you can watch it on demand. But also we have two channels. We have Charter Channel 995 and Time Warner 363.
Okay.
So please tune in.
Okay.
Please.
Yeah, please. It's worth seeing. That's tonight.
Tonight at
8
p.m., tomorrow night at 9 on Channel 36.
All right. Happy Earth Day.
Happy Earth Day, Kathleen. Glad to be here again.
Yeah, great
Thank
to have you,
you
here.
Thank you so much.
Our thanks to our guests for being with us this hour to talk about the river and the lake and for their having done a documentary that really is well worth your seeing. So watch it tonight. John Gerda, Milwaukee historian, has joined us many times before. Claudia Luz is an independent filmmaker who worked on tonight's documentary and also worked with John on the very big Making of Milwaukee effort. We thank them both. And thanks to KP Whaley and Scotty Myers for producing this hour. Tomorrow, during this hour, this story has been really haunting me this week. I've spent some time on the Mediterranean years ago and sailed on it and think it's beautiful. Well, now all I can think about are the people who are dying, who are trying to get away from Libya and other places in Africa. We'll be talking about these boats that have been carrying thousands of people, many of them from northern Africa, and they're capsizing, and people are dying in huge numbers. So what's the reason behind many people wanting to make a perilous journey in a horrible boat to get to Europe, and what has the European response been? We'll be talking about that with somebody who took the journey and also with a political science professor who understands immigration problems in Europe. So that will be tomorrow. And then that's the first hour. Hour two, a Lake Mills veterinarian who wrote a weekly column for the newspaper for some time, and he's gathered the stories into a new book, In Harriet's Shadow, the stories of the human-animal bond and how it doesn't apply just to cats and dogs, but all creatures, great and small. How could you miss that one? News is coming up from National Public Radio. Thanks, everybody, for listening and for your phone calls and questions, and thanks to all of our guests. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.